Chapter 62. The noon sun glinted off the sleek roof of Italy's high-velocity Frecciargento train as it raced northward, cutting a graceful arc across the Tuscan countryside. Despite traveling away from Florence at 174 miles per hour, the Silver Arrow train made almost no noise, its soft, repetitive clicking and gently swaying motion having an almost soothing effect on those who rode it. For Robert Langdon, the last hour had been a blur. Now, aboard the high-speed train, Langdon, Sienna, and Dr. Ferris were seated in one of the Frecciargento's private salottini, a small executive-class berth with four leather seats and a fold-out table. Ferris had rented the entire cabin using his credit card, along with an assortment of sandwiches and mineral water, which Langdon and Sienna had ravenously consumed after cleaning up in the restroom next to their private berth. As the three of them settled in for the two-hour train ride to Venice, Dr. Ferris immediately turned his gaze to the Dante death mask, which sat on the table between them in its Ziploc bag. "We need to figure out precisely where in Venice this mask is leading us."
"And quickly," Sienna added, urgency in her voice. "It's probably our only hope of preventing Zobrist's plague."
"Hold on," Langdon said, placing a defensive hand atop the mask. "You promised that once we were safely aboard this train, you would give me some answers about the last few days. So far, all I know is that the WHO recruited me in Cambridge to help decipher Zobrist's version of La Mappa. Other than that, you've told me nothing." Dr. Ferris shifted uncomfortably and began scratching again at the rash on his face and neck.
"I can see you're frustrated," he said. "I'm sure it's unsettling not to remember what happened, but medically speaking..."
He glanced over at Sienna for confirmation and then continued,
"I strongly recommend you not expend energy trying to recall specifics you can't remember. With amnesia victims, it's best just to let the forgotten past remain forgotten."
"Let it be?" Langdon felt his anger rising. "The hell with that. I need some answers. Your organization brought me to Italy, where I was shot and lost several days of my life. I want to know how it happened."
"Robert," Sienna intervened, speaking softly in a clear attempt to calm him down, "Dr. Ferris is right. It definitely would not be healthy for you to be overwhelmed by a deluge of information all at once. Think about the tiny snippets you do remember. The silver-haired woman. Seek and find. The writhing bodies from La Mappa. Those images flooded into your mind in a series of jumbled, uncontrollable flashbacks that left you nearly incapacitated. If Dr. Ferris starts recounting the past few days, he will almost certainly dislodge other memories, and your hallucinations could start all over again. Retrograde amnesia is a serious condition. Triggering misplaced memories can be extremely disruptive to the psyche."
The thought had not occurred to Langdon. "You must feel quite disoriented," Ferris added. "But at the moment, we need your psyche intact so we can move forward. It's imperative that we figure out what this mask is trying to tell us." Sienna nodded. The doctors, Langdon noted silently, seemed to agree. Langdon sat quietly, trying to overcome his feelings of uncertainty. It was a strange sensation to meet a total stranger and realize you had actually known him for several days. Then again, Langdon thought, there is something vaguely familiar about his eyes.
"Professor," Ferris said sympathetically, "I can see that you're not sure you trust me, and this is understandable considering all you've been through. One of the common side effects of amnesia is mild paranoia and distrust."
"That makes sense," Langdon thought, "considering I can't even trust my own mind."
"Speaking of paranoia," Sienna joked, clearly trying to lighten the mood, "Robert saw your rash and thought you'd been stricken with the Black Plague."
Ferris's puffy eyes widened, and he laughed out loud.
"This rash? Believe me, Professor, if I had the plague, I would not be treating it with an over-the-counter antihistamine."
He pulled out a small tube of medicine from his pocket and tossed it to Langdon. Sure enough, it was a half-empty tube of anti-itch cream for allergic reactions. "Sorry about that," Langdon said, feeling foolish. "Long day."
"No worries," Ferris said.
Langdon turned toward the window,
watching the muted hues of the Italian countryside blur together in a peaceful collage. The vineyards and farms were becoming scarcer now, as the flatlands gave way to the foothills of the Apennines. Soon the train would navigate the sinuous mountain pass, and then descend again, powering eastward toward the Adriatic Sea. "I'm headed for Venice," he thought, "to look for a plague." This strange day had left Langdon feeling as if he were moving through a landscape composed of nothing but vague shapes, with no particular details, like a dream. Ironically, nightmares usually woke people up, but Langdon felt as if he had awoken into one.
"Lyra for your thoughts?"
Sienna whispered beside him. Langdon glanced up, smiling wearily. "I keep thinking I'll wake up at home and discover this was all a bad dream." Sienna cocked her head, looking demure.
"You wouldn't miss me if you woke up and found out I wasn't real?"
Langdon had to grin. "Yes, actually. I would miss you a little." She patted his knee.
"Stop daydreaming, Professor, and get to work."
Langdon reluctantly turned his eyes to the crinkled face of Dante Alighieri, which stared blankly up from the table before him. Gently, Langdon picked up the plaster mask and turned it over in his hands, gazing down into the concave interior at the first line of spiral text. "O you possessed of sturdy intellect." Langdon doubted he qualified at the moment. Nonetheless, he set to work. 200 miles ahead of the speeding train, the Mendacham remained anchored in the Adriatic. Below decks, facilitator Lawrence Knowlton heard the soft rap of knuckles on his glass cubicle and touched a button beneath his desk, turning the opaque wall into a transparent one. Outside, a small, tanned form materialized. The provost. He looked grim. Without a word, he entered, locked the cubicle door, and threw the switch that turned the glass room opaque again. He smelled of alcohol.
"The video that Zobrist left us," the provost said.
"Yes, sir?"
"I want to see it. Now."
Chapter 63. Robert Langdon had now finished transcribing the spiral text from the death mask onto paper so they could analyze it more closely. Sienna and Dr. Ferris huddled in close to help, and Langdon did his best to ignore Ferris's ongoing scratching and labored breathing. "He's fine," Langdon told himself, forcing his attention to the verse before him. "O you possessed of sturdy intellect, observe the teaching that is hidden here, beneath the veil of verses so obscure." "As I mentioned earlier," Langdon began, "the opening stanza of Zobrist's poem is taken verbatim from Dante's Inferno, an admonition to the reader that the words carry a deeper meaning. Dante's allegorical work was so replete with veiled commentary on religion, politics, and philosophy that Langdon often suggested to his students that the Italian poet be studied much as one might study the Bible, reading between the lines in an effort to understand the deeper meaning. Scholars of medieval allegory," Langdon continued, "generally divide their analyses into two categories, text and image. Text being the literal content of the work, and image being the symbolic message."
"Okay," Ferris said eagerly. "So the fact that the poem begins with this line
suggests," Sienna interjected, "that our superficial reading may reveal only part of the story. The true meaning may be hidden."
"Something like that, yes." Langdon returned his gaze to the text and continued reading aloud. "Seek the treacherous Doge of Venice, who severed the heads from horses and plucked up the bones of the blind." "Well," Langdon said, "I'm not sure about headless horses and the bones of the blind, but it sounds like we're supposed to locate a specific Doge."
"I assume a Doge's grave?"
Sienna asked. "Or a statue or portrait," Langdon replied. "There haven't been Doges for centuries." "The Doges of Venice were similar to the dukes of the other Italian city-states, and more than 100 of them had ruled Venice over the course of 1,000 years, beginning in A.D. 697. Their lineage had ended in the late 18th century with Napoleon's conquest.
but their glory and power still remain subject of intense fascination for historians.
As you may know, Langdon said, Venice's two most popular tourist attractions, the Doge's Palace and St. Mark's Basilica, were built by the Doge's for the Doge's. Many of them are buried right there.
And do you know, Sienna asked, eyeing the poem, if there was a Doge who was considered to be particularly dangerous?
Langdon glanced down at the line in question. Seek the treacherous Doge of Venice. None that I know of. But the poem doesn't use the word dangerous. It uses the word treacherous. There's a difference, at least in the world of Dante. Treachery is one of the seven deadly sins, the worst of them, actually, punished in the ninth and final ring of hell.
Treachery, as defined by Dante, was the act of betraying a loved one. History's most notorious example of the sin had been Judas's betrayal of his beloved Jesus, an act Dante considered so vile that he had Judas banished to the Inferno's innermost core, a region named Giudecca, after its most dishonorable resident.
Okay, Ferris said. So we're looking for a Doge who committed an act of treachery.
Sienna nodded her agreement.
That will help us limit the list of possibilities.
She paused, eyeing the text.
But this next line, a Doge who severed the heads from horses.
She raised her eyes to Langdon.
Is there a Doge who cut off horses' heads?
The image Sienna evoked in his mind reminded Langdon of the gruesome scene from The Godfather. Doesn't ring a bell. But according to this, he also plucked up the bones of the blind. He glanced over at Ferris. Your phone has internet, right? Ferris quickly pulled out his phone and held up his swollen, rashy fingertips.
The buttons might be difficult for me to manage. I've got it, Sienna said, taking his phone. I'll run a search for Venetian doges, cross-referenced with headless horses and the bones of the blind.
She began typing rapidly on the tiny keyboard. Langdon skimmed the poem another time, and then continued reading aloud. Kneel within the gilded mosaic of holy wisdom, and place thine ear to the ground, listening for the sounds of trickling water.
I've never heard of a mosaic, Ferris said.
It's an ancient word meaning a temple protected by muses, Langdon replied. In the days of the early Greeks, a mosaeon was a place where the enlightened gathered to share ideas and discuss literature, music, and art.
The first mosaeon was built by Ptolemy at the Library of Alexandria centuries before the birth of Christ, and then hundreds more cropped up around the world.
Dr. Brooks, Ferris said, glancing hopefully at Sienna, can you look and see if there's a mosaeon in Venice?
Actually, there are dozens of them, Langdon said with a playful smile. Now they're called museums.
Ah, Ferris replied. I guess we'll have to cast a wider net.
Sienna kept typing into the phone, having no trouble multitasking as she calmly took inventory.
Okay, so we're looking for a museum where we can find a Doge who severed the heads from horses and plucked up the bones of the blind. Robert, is there a particular museum that might be a good place to look?
Langdon was already considering all of Venice's best-known museums. The Gallery dell'Accademia, the Ca Resonico, the Palazzo Grassi, the Peggy Guggenheim Collection, the Museo Correr. But none of them seemed to fit the description. He glanced back at the text. Kneel within the gilded mosaic of holy wisdom. Langdon smiled wryly. Venice does have one museum that perfectly qualifies as a gilded mosaic of holy wisdom. Both Ferris and Sienna looked at him expectantly. St. Mark's Basilica, he declared, the largest church in Venice. Ferris looked uncertain.
The church is a museum?
Langdon nodded, much like the Vatican Museum. And what's more, the interior of St. Mark's is famous for being adorned in its entirety in solid gold tiles.
A gilded mosaic,
Sienna said, sounding genuinely excited. Langdon nodded, having no doubt that St. Mark's was the gilded temple referenced in the poem. For centuries, the Venetians had called St. Mark's La Chiesa d'Oro, the Church of Gold, and Langdon considered its interior the most dazzling of any church in the world.
The poem says to kneel there, Ferris added, and a church is a logical place to kneel.
Sienna was typing furiously again.
I'll add St. Mark's to the search. That must be where we need to look for the Doge.
Langdon knew they would find no shortage of Doges in St. Mark's, which was, quite literally, the Basilica of the Doges. He felt encouraged as he returned his eyes to the poem.
Kneel within the gilded mosaic of holy wisdom and place thine ear to the ground, listening for the sounds of trickling water.
Trickling water? Langdon wondered. Is there water under St. Mark's? The question, he realized, was foolish. There was water under the entire city. Every building in Venice was slowly sinking and leaking. Langdon pictured the basilica and tried to imagine where inside one might kneel to listen for trickling water. And once we hear it, what do we do?
Langdon returned to the poem and finished reading aloud. Follow deep into the sunken palace, for here, in the darkness, the thonic monster waits, submerged in the blood-red waters of the lagoon that reflects no stars.
Okay, Langdon said, disturbed by the image. Apparently we follow the sounds of trickling water to some kind of sunken palace.
Ferris scratched at his face, looking unnerved.
What's a thonic monster? Subterranean, Sienna offered, her fingers still working the phone. Thonic means beneath the earth.
Partly, yes, Langdon said. Although the word has a further historic implication, one commonly associated with myths and monsters, thonics are an entire category of mythical gods and monsters. Erinyes, Hecate, and Medusa, for example. They're called thonics because they reside in the underworld and are associated with hell.
Langdon paused.
Historically, they emerge from the earth and come above ground to wreak havoc in the human world. There was a long silence, and Langdon sensed they were all thinking the same thing. This thonic monster could only be Zobrist's plague. For here in the darkness the thonic monster waits, submerged in the blood-red waters of the lagoon that reflects no stars.
Anyway, Langdon said, trying to stay on track, we're obviously looking for an underground location, which at least explains the last line of the poem referencing the lagoon that reflects no stars.
Good point, Sienna said, glancing up now from Ferris's phone. If a lagoon is subterranean, it couldn't reflect the sky. But does Venice have subterranean lagoons?
Not that I know of, Langdon replied. But in a city built on water, there are probably endless possibilities.
What if the lagoon is indoors?
Sienna asked suddenly, eyeing them both.
The poem refers to the darkness of the sunken palace. You mentioned earlier that the Doge's palace is connected to the basilica, right? That means those structures have a lot of what the poem mentions. A mosaic of holy wisdom, a palace, relevance to Doge's, and it's all located right there on Venice's main lagoon, at sea level.
Langdon considered this.
You think the poem's sunken palace is the Doge's palace?
Why not? The poem tells us first to kneel at St. Mark's Basilica, then to follow the sounds of trickling water. Maybe the sounds of water lead next door to the Doge's palace. It could have a submerged foundation or something.
Langdon had visited the Doge's palace many times and knew that it was absolutely massive. A sprawling complex of buildings, the palace housed a grand-scale museum, a veritable labyrinth of institutional chambers, apartments, and courtyards, and a prison network so vast that it was housed in multiple buildings.
You may be right, Langdon said, but a blind search of that palace would take days.
I suggest we do exactly as the poem tells us. First, we go to St. Mark's Basilica and find the tomb or statue of this treacherous Doge, and then we kneel down.
And then?
Sienna asked.
And then, Langdon said with a sigh, we pray like hell that we hear trickling water, and it leads us somewhere.
In the silence that followed, Langdon pictured the anxious face of Elizabeth Sinsky, as he had seen it in his hallucinations, calling to him across the water.
Time is short. Seek and find.
He wondered where Sinsky was now, and if she was all right. The soldiers in black had no doubt realized by now that Langdon and Sienna had escaped.
How long until they come after us? As Langdon returned his eyes to the poem, he fought off a wave of exhaustion. He eyed the final line of verse, and another thought occurred to him. He wondered if it was even worth mentioning. The lagoon that reflects no stars. It was probably irrelevant to their search, but he decided to share it nonetheless. There's another point I should mention. Sienna glanced up from the cell phone. The three sections of Dante's Divine Comedy, Langdon said. Inferno, Purgatorio, and Paradiso. They all end with the exact same word. Sienna looked surprised. What word is that? Ferris asked. Langdon pointed to the bottom of the text he had transcribed. The same word that ends this poem. Stars. He picked up Dante's death mask and pointed to the very center of the spiral text. The lagoon that reflects no stars. What's more, Langdon continued, in the finale of the Inferno, we find Dante listening to the sound of trickling water inside a chasm and following it through an opening, which leads him out of hell. Ferris blanched slightly. Jesus. Just then a deafening rush of air filled the cabin, as the Frecciargento plunged into a mountain tunnel. In the darkness, Langdon closed his eyes and tried to allow his mind to relax. Zobrist may have been a lunatic, he thought, but he certainly had a sophisticated grasp of Dante. Chapter 64. Lawrence Knowlton felt a wave of relief wash over him. The provost changed his mind about watching Zobrist's video. Knowlton practically dove for the crimson memory stick and inserted it into his computer so he could share it with his boss. The weight of Zobrist's bizarre 9-minute message had been haunting the facilitator, and he was eager to have another set of eyes watch it. This will no longer be on me. Knowlton held his breath as he began the playback. The screen darkened, and the sounds of gently lapping water filled the cubicle. The camera moved through the reddish haze of the underground cavern, and although the provost showed no visible reaction, Knowlton sensed that the man was as alarmed as he was bewildered. The camera paused its forward motion and tipped downward at the surface of the lagoon, where it plunged beneath the water, diving several feet to reveal the polished titanium plaque bolted to the floor. In this place, on this date, the world was changed forever. The provost flinched ever so slightly. Tomorrow, he whispered, eyeing the date. And do we know where this place might be? Knowlton shook his head. The camera panned left now, revealing the submerged plastic sack of gelatinous yellow-brown fluid. What in God's name? The provost pulled up a chair and settled in, staring at the undulating bubble, suspended like a tethered balloon beneath the water. An uncomfortable silence settled over the room as the video progressed. Soon the screen went dark, and then a strange, beak-nosed shadow appeared on the cavern wall and began talking in its arcane language.
I am the shade. Driven underground, I must speak to the world from deep within the earth. Exiled to this gloomy cavern where the blood-red waters collect in the lagoon that reflects no stars. But this is my paradise, the perfect womb for my fragile child, Inferno.
The provost glanced up.
Inferno?
Knowlton shrugged. As I said, it's disturbing. The provost returned his eyes to the screen, watching intently. The beak-nosed shadow continued speaking for several minutes, talking of plagues, of the population's need for purging, of his own glorious role in the future, of his battle against the ignorant souls who had been trying to stop him, and of the faithful few who realized that drastic action was the only way to save the planet. Whatever this war was about, Knowlton had been wondering all morning if the consortium might be fighting on the wrong side. The voice continued.
I have forged a masterpiece of salvation, and yet my efforts have been rewarded not with trumpets and laurels, but with threats of death. I do not fear death, for death transforms visionaries into martyrs. converts noble ideas into powerful movements. Jesus, Socrates, Martin Luther King. One day soon, I will join them. The masterpiece I have created is the work of God himself, a gift from the one who imbued me with the intellect, tools, and courage required to forge such a creation. Now the day grows near. Inferno sleeps beneath me, preparing to spring from its watery womb under the watchful eye of the Thonic monster and all her furies. Despite the virtue of my deeds, like you, I am no stranger to sin. Even I am guilty of the darkest of the seven, that lone temptation from which so few find sanctuary. Pride. By recording this very message, I have succumbed to pride's goading pull, eager to ensure that the world would know my work. And why not? Mankind should know the source of his own salvation, the name of he who sealed the yawning gates of hell forever. With each passing hour, the outcome grows more certain. Mathematics, as relentless as the law of gravity, is non-negotiable. The same exponential blossoming of life that has nearly killed mankind shall also be his deliverance. The beauty of a living organism, be it good or evil, is that it will follow the law of God with singular vision. Be fruitful and multiply. And so, I fight fire with fire.
That's enough. The provost interrupted so quietly that Knowlton barely heard him. Sir? Stop the video. Knowlton paused the playback. Sir, the end is actually the most frightening part. I've seen enough. The provost looked ill. He paced the cubicle for several moments and then turned suddenly. We need to make contact with FS-2080. Knowlton considered the move. FS-2080 was the code name of one of the provost's trusted contacts, the same contact who had referred Zobrist to the consortium as a client. The provost was no doubt at this very moment chiding himself for trusting FS-2080's judgment. The recommendation of Bertrand Zobrist as a client had brought chaos into the consortium's delicately structured world. FS-2080 is the reason for this crisis. The growing chain of calamities surrounding Zobrist only seemed to be getting worse, not merely for the consortium, but quite possibly for the world. We need to discover Zobrist's true intentions, the provost declared. I want to know exactly what he created and if this threat is real. Knowlton knew that if anyone had the answers to these questions, it would be FS-2080. Nobody knew Bertrand Zobrist better. It was time for the consortium to break protocol and assess what kind of insanity the organization might have unwittingly supported over the past year. Knowlton considered the possible ramifications of confronting FS-2080 directly. The mere act of initiating contact carried certain risks. Obviously, sir, Knowlton said, if you reach out to FS-2080, you'll need to do so very delicately. The provost's eyes flashed with anger as he pulled out his cell phone. We're well past delicate. Seated with his two traveling partners in the Frecciargento's private cabin, the man with the paisley necktie and plume Paris glasses did his best not to scratch at his still worsening rash. The pain in his chest seemed to have increased as well. As the train finally emerged from the tunnel, the man gazed over at Langdon, who opened his eyes slowly, apparently returning from far-off thoughts. Beside him, Sienna began eyeing the man's cell phone, which she had set down as the train sped through the tunnel, while there was no signal. Sienna appeared eager to continue her internet search, but before she could reach for the phone, it suddenly began vibrating, emitting a series of staccato pings. Knowing the ring well, the man with the rash immediately grabbed the phone and eyed the illuminated screen, doing his best to hide his surprise. Sorry, he said, standing up. Ailing mother, I've got to take this. Sienna and Langdon gave him understanding nods as the man excused himself and exited the cabin. moving quickly down the passageway into a nearby restroom. The man with the rash locked the restroom door as he took the call. Hello? The voice on the line was grave.
It's the provost.
Chapter 65. The Frecce Argento's restroom was no larger than the restroom on a commercial airliner, with barely enough room to turn around. The man with the skin rash finished his phone call with the provost and pocketed his phone.
The ground has shifted, he realized.
The entire landscape was suddenly upside down, and he needed a moment to get his bearings.
My friends are now my enemies.
The man loosened his paisley tie and stared at his pustuled face in the mirror. He looked worse than he thought. His face was of little concern, though, compared to the pain in his chest. Hesitantly, he unfastened several buttons and pulled open his shirt. He forced his eyes to the mirror and studied his bare chest.
Jesus!
The black area was growing. The skin on the center of his chest was a deep hue of bluish black. The area had begun last night as the size of a golf ball, but now it was the size of an orange. He gently touched the tender flesh and winced. Hurriedly, he rebuttoned his shirt, hoping he would have the strength to carry out what he needed to do.
The next hour will be critical, he thought. A delicate series of maneuvers.
He closed his eyes and gathered himself, working through what needed to happen.
My friends have become my enemies, he thought again.
He took several deep, painful breaths, hoping it might calm his nerves. He knew he needed to stay serene if he was going to keep his intentions hidden.
Inner calm is critical to persuasive acting.
The man was no stranger to deception, and yet his heart was pounding wildly now. He took another deep, throbbing breath.
You've been deceiving people for years, he reminded himself. It's what you do.
Steeling himself, he prepared to return to Langdon and Sienna.
My final performance, he thought.
As a final precaution before exiting the restroom, he removed the battery from his cell phone, making sure the device was now inoperative.
He looks pale, Sienna thought as the man with the rash re-entered the cabin and settled into his seat with a pained sigh. Is everything okay?
Sienna asked, genuinely concerned. He nodded.
Thanks, yes, everything's fine.
Apparently, having received all the information the man intended to share, Sienna changed tacks.
I need your phone again, she said. If you don't mind, I want to keep searching for more on the doge. Maybe we can get some answers before we visit St. Mark's.
No problem, he said, taking his phone from his pocket and checking the display.
Oh, damn. My battery was dying during that call. Looks like it's dead now.
He glanced at his watch.
We'll be in Venice soon. We'll just have to wait.
5 miles off the coast of Italy, aboard the Mendacium, facilitator Knowlton watched in silence as the provost stalked around the perimeter of the cubicle like a caged animal. Following the phone call, the provost's wheels were clearly turning, and Knowlton knew better than to utter a sound while the provost was thinking. Finally, the deeply tanned man spoke, his voice as tight as Knowlton could remember.
We have no choice. We need to share this video with Dr. Elizabeth Sinsky.
Knowlton sat stock still, not wanting to show his surprise.
The silver-haired devil? The one we've helped Zobrist evade all year?
Okay, sir. Should I find a way to email the video to her?
God, no. And risk leaking the video to the public? It would be mass hysteria. I want Dr. Sinsky aboard this ship as soon as you can get her here.
Knowlton stared in disbelief. He wants to bring the director of the WHO on board the Mendacium?
Sir, this breach of our secrecy protocol obviously risks...
Just do it, Knowlton.
Now!
Chapter 66. FS-2080 gazed out the window of the speeding Frecce Argento, watching Robert Langdon's reflection in the glass. The professor was still brainstorming possible solutions to the death mask riddle that Bertrand Zobrist had composed.
Bertrand,
thought FS-2080. God, I miss him. The pangs of loss felt fresh. The night the two had met still felt like a magical dream. Chicago. The blizzard. January 6 years ago. But it still feels like yesterday. I am trudging through snowbanks along the windswept, magnificent mile, collar upturned against the blinding whiteout. Despite the cold, I tell myself that nothing will keep me from my destination. Tonight is my chance to hear the great Bertrand Zobris speak, in person. I have read everything the man has ever written, and I know I am lucky to have one of the 500 tickets that were printed for the event. When I arrive at the hall, half numb from the wind, I feel a surge of panic to discover the room nearly empty. Has the speech been canceled? The city is in near shutdown due to the weather. Has it kept Zobrist from coming tonight? Then he is there. A towering, elegant form takes the stage. He is tall, so very tall, with vibrant green eyes that seem to hold all the mysteries of the world in their depths. He looks out over the empty hall, only a dozen or so stalwart fans, and I feel ashamed that the hall is nearly empty. This is Bertrand Zobrist. There is a terrible moment of silence as he stares at us, his face stern. Then, without warning, he bursts out laughing, his green eyes glimmering. To hell with this empty auditorium, he declares. My hotel is next door, let's go to the bar. A cheer goes up, and a small group migrates next door to a hotel bar where we crowd into a big booth and order drinks. Zobrist regales us with tales of his research, his rise to celebrity, and his thoughts about the future of genetic engineering. As the drinks flow, the topic turns to Zobrist's newfound passion for transhumanist philosophy. I believe transhumanism is mankind's only hope for long-term survival, Zobrist preaches, pulling aside his shirt and showing them all the H-plus tattoo inscribed on his shoulder. As you can see, I'm fully committed. I feel as if I'm having a private audience with a rock star. I never imagined the lauded genius of genetics would be so charismatic or beguiling in person. Every time Zobrist glances over at me, his green eyes ignite a wholly unexpected feeling inside me. The deep pull of sexual attraction. As the night wears on, the group slowly thins as the guests excuse themselves to get back to reality. By midnight, I am seated all alone with Bertrand Zobrist. Thank you for tonight, I say to him, a little tipsy from one drink too many. You're an amazing teacher. Flattery? Zobrist smiles and leans closer, our legs touching now. It will get you everywhere. The flirtation is clearly inappropriate, but it is a snowy night in a deserted Chicago hotel, and it feels as if the entire world has stopped. So what do you think? Zobrist says. Nightcap in my room? I freeze, knowing I must look like a deer in the headlights. Zobrist's eyes twinkle warmly. Let me guess, he whispers. You've never been with a famous man. I feel myself flush, fighting to hide a surge of emotions, embarrassment, excitement, fear. Actually, to be honest, I say to him, I've never been with any man. Zobrist smiles and inches closer. I'm not sure what you've been waiting for, but please let me be your first. In that moment, all the awkward sexual fears and frustrations of my childhood disappear, evaporating into the snowy night. For the first time ever, I feel a yearning unfettered by shame. I want him. 10 minutes later, we are in Zobrist's hotel room, naked in each other's arms. Zobrist takes his time, his patient hands coaxing sensations I've never felt before out of my inexperienced body. This is my choice. He didn't force me. In the cocoon of Zobrist's embrace, I feel as if everything is right in the world. Lying there, staring out the window at the snowy night, I know I will follow this man anywhere. The Frecciargento train slowed suddenly, and FS-2080 emerged from the blissful memory and back into the depressing present. Bertrand, you're gone. Their first night together had been the first step of an incredible journey.
I became more than his lover. I became his disciple.
Libertad Bridge, Langdon said. We're almost there. FS 2080 nodded mournfully, staring out at the waters of the Laguna Veneta, remembering sailing here once with Bertrand, a peaceful image that dissolved now into a horrific memory from a week before.
I was there when he jumped off the Badia Tower. Mine were the last eyes he ever saw.
Chapter 67. The NetJet's Citation Excel bounced through heavy turbulence as it rocketed skyward out of Tassignano Airport and banked toward Venice. On board, Dr. Elizabeth Sinsky barely noticed the bumpy departure as she absently stroked her amulet and gazed out the window into empty space. They had finally stopped giving her the injections, and Sinsky's mind was already feeling clearer. In the seat beside her, Agent Bruder remained silent, probably pondering the bizarre turn of events that had just transpired.
Everything is upside down,
Sinsky thought, still struggling to believe what she had just witnessed. 30 minutes ago, they had stormed the tiny airfield to intercept Langdon as he boarded the private jet he had summoned. Instead of finding the professor, however, they discovered an idling Citation Excel and 2 NetJets pilots pacing the tarmac and checking their watches. Robert Langdon was a no-show.
Then came the phone call.
When the cell phone rang, Sinsky was where she had been all day, in the back seat of the black van. Agent Bruder entered the vehicle with a stupefied look on his face as he handed her his phone.
Urgent call for you, ma'am.
Who is it?
She asked.
He asked me to tell you only that he has pressing information to give you about Bertrand Zobrist.
Sinsky grabbed the phone.
This is Dr. Elizabeth Sinsky?
Dr. Sinsky? You and I have never met, but my organization has been responsible for hiding Bertrand Zobrist from you for the last year.
Sinsky sat bolt upright.
Whoever the hell you are, you've been harboring a criminal.
We've done nothing illegal, but that's not...
The hell you haven't.
The man on the line took a long, patient breath, speaking very softly now.
You and I will have plenty of time to debate the ethics of my actions. I know you don't know me, but I do know quite a bit about you. Mr. Zobrist has been paying me handsomely to keep you and others away from him for the past year. I am now breaching my own strict protocol by contacting you. And yet, I believe we have no choice but to pool our resources. Bertrand Zobrist, I fear, may have done something terrible.
Sinsky could not fathom who this man was.
You're just figuring this out now?
Yes. That is correct, just now.
His tone was earnest. Sinsky tried to shake off the cobwebs.
Who are you?
Someone who wants to help you before it's too late. I'm in possession of a video message created by Bertrand Zobrist. He asked me to release it to the world tomorrow. I think you need to see it immediately.
What does it say?
Not on the phone. We need to meet.
How do I know I can trust you?
Because I'm about to tell you where Robert Langdon is, and why he's acting so strangely.
Sinsky reeled at the mention of Langdon's name, and she listened in astonishment to the outlandish explanation. This man seemed to have been complicit with her enemy for the last year, and yet, as she listened to the details, Sinsky's gut told her she needed to trust what he was saying.
I have no choice but to comply.
Their combined resources made short work of commandeering the jilted NetJet's Citation XL. Sinsky and the soldiers were now in pursuit, racing toward Venice, where, according to this man's information, Langdon and his 2 traveling companions were at this very moment arriving by train. It was too late to summon the local authorities, but the man on the line claimed to know where Langdon was headed.
St. Mark's Square.
Sinsky felt a chill as she imagined the crowds in Venice's most populated area.
How do you know this?
Not on the phone, the man said. But you should be aware that Robert Langdon is unwittingly traveling with a very dangerous individual.
Who?
Sinsky demanded.
One of Zobrist's closest confidants.
The man sighed heavily. Someone I trusted. Foolishly, apparently. Someone I believe may now be a severe threat.
As the private jet headed for Venice's Marco Polo Airport carrying Sinsky and the six soldiers, Sinsky's thoughts returned to Robert Langdon.
He lost his memory? He recalls nothing?
The strange news, while explaining several things, made Sinsky feel even worse than she already did about involving the distinguished academic in this crisis.
I left him no choice.
Almost 2 days ago, when Sinsky recruited Langdon, she hadn't even let him go back to his house for his passport. Instead, she had arranged for his quiet passage through the Florence airport as a special liaison to the World Health Organization. As the C-130 lumbered into the air and pointed east across the Atlantic, Sinsky had glanced at Langdon beside her and noticed he did not look well. He was staring intently at the sidewall of the windowless hull.
Professor, you do realize this plane has no windows. Until recently, it was used as a military transport.
Langdon turned, his face ashen. Yes, I noticed that the moment I stepped aboard. I'm not so good in enclosed spaces.
So you're pretending to look out an imaginary window?
He gave a sheepish smile. Something like that, yes.
Well, look at this instead.
She pulled out a photo of her lanky, green-eyed nemesis and laid it in front of him.
This is Bertrand Zobrist.
Sinsky had already told Langdon about her confrontation with Zobrist at the Council on Foreign Relations, the man's passion for the population apocalypse equation, his widely circulated comments about the global benefits of the Black Plague and, most ominously, his total disappearance from sight over the past year. How does someone that prominent stay hidden for so long? Langdon asked.
He had a lot of help. Professional help. Maybe even a foreign government.
What government would condone the creation of a plague?
The same governments that tried to obtain nuclear warheads on the black market. Don't forget that an effective plague is the ultimate biochemical weapon, and it's worth a fortune.
Zobrist easily could have lied to his partners and assured them his creation had a limited range. Zobrist would be the only one who had any idea what his creation actually did. Langdon fell silent.
In any case, Sinsky continued, if not for power or money, those helping Zobrist could have helped because they shared his ideology. Zobrist has no shortage of disciples who would do anything for him. He was quite a celebrity. In fact, he gave a speech at your university not long ago.
At Harvard? Sinsky took out a pen and wrote on the border of Zobrist's photo, the letter H followed by a plus sign.
You're good with symbols, she said. Do you recognize this one?
H plus, Langdon whispered, nodding vaguely. Sure, a few summers ago it was posted all over campus. I assumed it was some kind of chemistry conference. Sinsky chuckled.
No, those were signs for the 2010 Humanity Plus Summit, one of the largest transhumanism gatherings ever. H plus is the symbol of the transhumanist movement.
Langdon cocked his head, as if trying to place the term.
Transhumanism, Sinsky said, is an intellectual movement, a philosophy of sorts, and it's quickly taking root in the scientific community. It essentially states that humans should use technology to transcend the weakness inherent in our human bodies. In other words, the next step in human evolution should be that we begin biologically engineering ourselves.
Sounds ominous, Langdon said.
Like all change, it's just a matter of degree.
Technically, we've been engineering ourselves for years now. Developing vaccines that make children immune to certain diseases. Polio, smallpox, typhoid. The difference is that now, with Zobrist's breakthroughs in germline genetic engineering, we're learning how to create inheritable immunizations. Those that would affect the recipient at the core germline level. Making all subsequent generations immune to that disease. Langdon looked startled.
So the human species would essentially undergo an evolution that makes it immune to typhoid, for example?
It's more of an assisted evolution, Sinsky corrected. Normally the evolutionary process, whether it be a lungfish developing feet or an ape developing opposable thumbs, takes millennia to occur. Now we can make radical genetic adaptations in a single generation. Proponents of the technology consider it the ultimate expression of Darwinian survival of the fittest, humans becoming a species that learns to improve its own evolutionary process.
Sounds more like playing God, Langdon replied.
I agree wholeheartedly, Sinsky said. Zobrist, however, like many other transhumanists, argued strongly that it is mankind's evolutionary obligation to use all the powers at our disposal. Germline genetic mutation, for one, to improve as a species. The problem is that our genetic makeup is like a house of cards, each piece connected to and supported by countless others, often in ways we don't understand. If we try to remove a single human trait, we can cause hundreds of others to shift simultaneously, possibly with catastrophic effects.
Langdon nodded. There's a reason evolution is a gradual process.
Precisely, Sinsky said,
feeling her admiration for the professor growing with each passing moment.
We're tinkering with a process that took eons to build. These are dangerous times. We now literally have the capacity to activate certain gene sequences that will result in our descendants having increased dexterity, stamina, strength, even intelligence. Essentially, a super race. These hypothetical enhanced individuals are what transhumanists refer to as post-humans, which some believe will be the future of our species.
Sounds eerily like eugenics, Langdon replied. The reference made Sinsky's skin crawl. In the 1940s, Nazi scientists had dabbled in a technology they dubbed eugenics, an attempt to use rudimentary genetic engineering to increase the birth rate of those with certain desirable genetic traits, while decreasing the birth rate of those with less desirable ethnic traits. Ethnic cleansing at the genetic level.
There are similarities, Sinsky admitted, and while it's hard to fathom how one would engineer a new human race, there are a lot of smart people who believe it is critical to our survival that we begin that very process. One of the contributors to the transhumanist magazine, H+, described germline genetic engineering as the clear next step and claimed it epitomized the true potential of our species.
Sinsky paused.
Then again, in the magazine's defense, they also ran a Discover magazine piece called The Most Dangerous Idea in the World.
I think I'd side with the latter, Langdon said. At least from the sociocultural standpoint.
How so?
Well, I assume that genetic enhancements, much like cosmetic surgery, cost a lot of money, right?
Of course. Not everyone could afford to improve themselves or their children.
Which means that legalized genetic enhancements would immediately create a world of haves and have-nots. We already have a growing chasm between the rich and the poor, but genetic engineering would create a race of superhumans and perceived subhumans. You think people are concerned about the ultra-rich 1% running the world? Just imagine if that 1% were also quite literally a superior species, smarter, stronger, healthier. It's the kind of situation that would be ripe for slavery or ethnic cleansing. Sinsky smiled at the handsome academic beside her.
Professor, you have very quickly grasped what I believe to be the most serious pitfall of genetic engineering.
Well, I may have grasped that, but I'm still confused about Zobrist. All of this transhumanist thinking seems to be about bettering humankind, making us more healthy, curing fatal diseases, extending our longevity. And yet, Zobrist's views on overpopulation seem to endorse killing off people. His ideas on transhumanism and overpopulation seem to be in conflict, don't they? Sinsky gave a solemn sigh. It was a good question, and unfortunately, it had a clear and troubling answer.
Zobrist believed wholeheartedly in transhumanism, in bettering the species through technology. However,
He also believed our species would go extinct before we got a chance to do that. In effect, if nobody takes action, our sheer numbers will kill off the species before we get a chance to realize the promise of genetic engineering.
Langdon's eyes went wide. So, Zobrist wanted to thin the herd in order to buy more time? Sinsky nodded.
He once described himself as being trapped on a ship where the passengers double in number every hour, while he is desperately trying to build a lifeboat before the ship sinks under its own weight.
She paused.
He advocated throwing half the people overboard.
Langdon winced. Frightening thought.
Quite. Make no mistake about it, she said. Zobrist firmly believed that a drastic curbing of the human population will be remembered one day as the ultimate act of heroism, the moment the human race chose to survive.
As I said, frightening.
More so because Zobrist was not alone in his thinking. When Zobrist died, he became a martyr for a lot of people. I have no idea who we're going to run into when we arrive in Florence. But we'll need to be very careful. We won't be the only ones trying to find this plague. And for your own safety, we can't let a soul know you're in Italy looking for it.
Langdon told her about his friend, Ignazio Busoni, a Dante specialist, who Langdon believed could get him into Palazzo Vecchio for a quiet after-hours look at the painting that contained the words, Cerca Trova, from Zobrist's little projector. Busoni might also be able to help Langdon understand the strange quote about the eyes of death. Sinsky pulled back her long silver hair and looked intently at Langdon.
Seek and find, Professor. Time is running out.
Sinsky went to an onboard storeroom and retrieved the WHO's most secure hazmat tube, a model with biometric sealing capability.
Give me your thumb,
she said, setting the canister in front of Langdon. Langdon looked puzzled but obliged. Sinsky programmed the tube so that Langdon would be the only person who could open it. Then she took the little projector and placed it safely inside.
Think of it as a portable lockbox, she said with a smile.
With a biohazard symbol? Langdon looked uneasy.
It's all we have. On the bright side, nobody will mess with it.
Langdon excused himself to stretch his legs and use the restroom. While he was gone, Sinsky tried to slip the sealed canister into his jacket pocket. Unfortunately, it didn't fit.
He can't be carrying this projector around in plain sight.
She thought a moment, and then headed back to the storeroom for a scalpel and a stitch kit. With expert precision, she cut a slit in the lining of Langdon's jacket and carefully sewed a hidden pocket that was the exact size required to conceal the biotube. When Langdon returned, she was just finishing the final stitches. The professor stopped and stared, as if she had defaced the Mona Lisa. You sliced into the lining of my Harris tweed?
Relax, Professor, she said. I'm a trained surgeon. The stitches are quite professional.
Chapter 68. Venice's Santa Lucia train station is an elegant, low-slung structure made of gray stone and concrete. It was designed in a modern, minimalist style, with a facade that is gracefully devoid of all signage except for one symbol, the winged letters FS, the icon of the state railway system, the Ferrovie dello Stato. Because the station is located at the westernmost end of the Grand Canal, passengers arriving in Venice need take only a single step out of the station to find themselves fully immersed in the distinctive sights, smells, and sounds of Venice. For Langdon, it was always the salty air that struck him first, a clean ocean breeze spiced by the aroma of white pizza sold by the street vendors outside the station. Today the wind was from the east, and the air also carried the tang of diesel fuel from the long line of water taxis idling nearby on the turgid waters of the Grand Canal. Dozens of boat captains waved their arms and shouted to tourists, hoping to lure a new fare onto their taxis, gondolas, vaporetti, and private speedboats. Chaos on the water, Langdon mused, eyeing the floating traffic jam. Somehow, the congestion that would be maddening in Boston felt quaint in Venice. A stone's throw across the canal, the iconic verdigris cupola of San Simeone Piccolo rose into the afternoon sky. The church was one of the most architecturally eclectic in all of Europe. Its unusually steep dome and circular sanctuary were Byzantine in style, while its columned marble pronaos was clearly modeled on the classical Greek entryway to Rome's Pantheon. The main entrance was topped by a spectacular pediment of intricate marble relief, portraying a host of martyred saints. Venice is an outdoor museum, Langdon thought, his gaze dropping to the canal water that lapped at the church's stairs. A slowly sinking museum. Even so, the potential of flooding seemed inconsequential compared to the threat that Langdon feared was now lurking beneath the city. And nobody has any idea. The poem on the back of Dante's death mask still played in Langdon's mind, and he wondered where the verses would lead them. He had the transcription of the poem in his pocket, but the plaster mask itself, at Sienna's suggestion, Langdon had wrapped in newspaper and discreetly sealed inside a self-serve locker in the train station. Although an egregiously inadequate resting place for such a precious artifact, the locker was certainly far safer than carrying the priceless plaster mask around a water-filled city.
Robert!
Sienna was up ahead with Ferris, motioning toward the water taxis.
We don't have much time.
Langdon hurried toward them, although as an architecture enthusiast, he found it almost unthinkable to rush a trip along the Grand Canal. Few Venetian experiences were more pleasurable than boarding Vaporetto No. 1, the city's primary open-air water bus, preferably at night, and sitting up front in the open air as the floodlit cathedrals and palaces drifted past. No Vaporetto today, Langdon thought. The Vaporetti water buses were notoriously slow, and water taxi would be a faster option. Unfortunately, the taxi queue outside the train station looked interminable at the moment. Ferris, in no apparent mood to wait, quickly took matters into his own hands. With a generous stack of bills, he quickly summoned over a water limousine, a highly polished Veneziano convertible made of South African mahogany. While the elegant craft was certainly overkill, the journey would be both private and swift, a mere 15 minutes along the Grand Canal to St. Mark's Square. The driver was a strikingly handsome man in a tailored Armani suit. He looked more like a movie star than a skipper, but this was, after all, Venice, the land of Italian elegance.
Maurizio Pimponi,
the man said, winking at Sienna as he welcomed them all aboard.
Prosecco? Limoncello? Champagne? No, grazie,
Sienna replied, instructing him in rapid-fire Italian to get them to St. Mark's Square as fast as he possibly could.
Ma certo,
Maurizio winked again.
My boat, she is the fastest in all of Venezia.
As Langdon and the others settled into plush seats in the open-air stern, Maurizio reversed the boat's Volvo Penta motor, expertly backing away from the bank. Then he spun the wheel to the right and gunned the engines forward, maneuvering his large craft through a throng of gondolas, leaving a number of striped-shirted gondolieri shaking their fists as their sleek black crafts bobbed up and down in his wake.
Scusate,
Maurizio called apologetically.
VIPs!
Within seconds, Maurizio had pulled away from the congestion at Santa Lucia station and was skimming eastward along the Grand Canal. As they accelerated beneath the graceful expanse of the Ponte degli Scalzi, Langdon smelled the distinctively sweet aroma of the local delicacy, seppi al nero, squid in its own ink, which was wafting out of the canopied restaurants along the bank nearby. As they rounded a bend in the canal, the massive domed church of San Geremia came into view. St. Lucia, Langdon whispered, reading the saint's name from the inscription on the side of the church. The bones of the blind.
I'm sorry?
Sienna glanced over, looking hopeful that Langdon might have figured out something more about the mysterious poem. Nothing, Langdon said. Strange thought. Probably nothing. He pointed to the church. See the inscription? St. Lucia is buried there. I sometimes lecture on hagiographic art, art depicting Christian saints.
and it just occurred to me that Saint Lucia is the patron saint of the blind.
Si, Santa Lucia,
Maurizio chimed in, eager to be of service.
Saint for the blind. You know the story, no?
Their driver looked back at them and shouted over the sound of the engines.
Lucia was so beautiful that all men have lust for her. So, Lucia, for to be pure to God and keep virginity, she cut out her own eyes.
Sienna groaned. There's commitment.
As reward for her sacrifice,
Maurizio added,
God gave Lucia an even more beautiful set of eyes.
Sienna looked at Langdon.
He does know that makes no sense, right?
The Lord works in mysterious ways, Langdon observed, picturing the 20 or so famous old master paintings depicting Saint Lucia carrying her own eyeballs on a platter. While there were numerous versions of the Saint Lucia tale, they all involved Lucia cutting out her lust-inducing eyes and placing them on a platter for her ardent suitor and defiantly declaring,
Here hast thou what thou so much desired, and for the rest I beseech thee, leave me now in peace.
Eerily, it had been Holy Scripture that had inspired Lucia's self-mutilation, forever linking her to Christ's famous admonition, If thine eye offend thee, pluck it out and cast it from thee. Pluck, Langdon thought, realizing the same word was used in the poem. Seek the treacherous Doge of Venice who plucked up the bones of the blind. Puzzled by the coincidence, he wondered if perhaps this was a cryptic indication that Saint Lucia was the blind person being referenced in the poem. Maurizio, Langdon shouted, pointing to the church of San Geremia. The bones of Saint Lucia are in that church, no?
A few, yes,
Maurizio said, driving skillfully with one hand and looking back at his passengers, ignoring the boat traffic ahead.
But mostly no. Saint Lucia is so beloved, her body has spread in churches all over the world. Venetians love Saint Lucia the most, of course, and so we celebrate—
Maurizio! Ferris shouted. Saint Lucia is blind, not you. Eyes front! Maurizio laughed good-naturedly and turned forward just in time to handily avoid colliding with an oncoming boat. Sienna was studying Langdon.
What are you getting at? The treacherous Doge who plucked up the bones of the blind?
Langdon pursed his lips. I'm not sure. He quickly told Sienna and Ferris the history of St. Lucia's relics, her bones, which was amongst the strangest in all of hagiography. Allegedly, when the beautiful Lucia refused the advances of an influential suitor, the man denounced her and had her burned at the stake, where, according to legend, her body refused to burn. Because her flesh had been resistant to fire, her relics were believed to have special powers, and whoever possessed them would enjoy an unusually long life.
Magic bones? Sienna said.
Believed to be, yes, which is the reason her relics have spread all over the world. For 2 millennia, powerful leaders have tried to thwart aging and death by possessing the bones of Saint Lucia. Her skeleton has been stolen, restolen, relocated, and divided up more times than that of any other saint in history. Her bones have passed through the hands of at least a dozen of history's most powerful people.
Including, Sienna inquired, a treacherous Doge?
Seek the treacherous Doge of Venice who severed the heads from horses and plucked up the bones of the blind. Quite possibly, Langdon said, now realizing that Dante's Inferno mentioned Saint Lucia very prominently. Lucia was one of the three blessed women, Le Tre Donne Benedette, who helped summon Virgil to help Dante escape the underworld. As the other two women were the Virgin Mary and Dante's beloved Beatrice, Dante had placed Saint Lucia in the highest of all company.
If you're right about this, Sienna said, excitement in her voice, then the same treacherous Doge who severed the heads from horses
also stole the bones of Saint Lucia, Langdon concluded. Sienna nodded.
Which should narrow our list considerably.
She glanced over at Ferris.
Are you sure your phone's not working? We might be able to search online for...
Stone dead, Ferris said. I just checked. Sorry. We'll be there soon, Langdon said. I have no doubt we'll be able to find some answers at St. Mark's Basilica. St. Mark's was the only piece of the puzzle that felt rock solid to Langdon. The Museum of Holy Wisdom.
Langdon was counting on the Basilica to reveal the identity of their mysterious doge, and from there, with luck, the specific palace that Zobrist had chosen to release his plague. For here, in the darkness, the Thonic monster waits. Langdon tried to push from his mind any images of the plague, but it was no use. He had often wondered what this incredible city had been like in its heyday, before the plague weakened it enough for it to be conquered by the Ottomans and then by Napoleon, back when Venice reigned gloriously as the commercial center of Europe. By all accounts, there was no more beautiful city in the world, the wealth and culture of its population unparalleled. Ironically, it was the population's taste for foreign luxuries that brought about its demise. The deadly plague traveling from China to Venice on the backs of rats stowed away on trading vessels. The same plague that destroyed an unfathomable two-thirds of China's population arrived in Europe and very quickly killed one in three, young and old, rich and poor alike. Langdon had read descriptions of life in Venice during the plague outbreaks. With little or no dry land in which to bury the dead, bloated bodies floated in the canals, with some areas so densely packed with corpses that workers had to labor like log rollers and prod the bodies out to sea. It seemed no amount of praying could diminish the plague's wrath. By the time city officials realized it was the rats that were causing the disease, it was too late. But Venice still enforced a decree by which all incoming vessels had to anchor offshore for a full 40 days before they would be permitted to unload. To this day, the number 40, quaranta in Italian, served as a grim reminder of the origins of the word quarantine. As their boat sped onward around another bend in the canal, a festive red awning luffed in the breeze, pulling Langdon's attention away from his grim thoughts of death toward an elegant three-tiered structure on his left. Casino di Venezia, an infinite emotion. While Langdon had never quite understood the words on the casino's banner, the spectacular Renaissance-style palace had been part of the Venetian landscape since the 16th century. Once a private mansion, it was now a black-tie gaming hall that was famous for being the site at which, in 1883, composer Richard Wagner had collapsed dead of a heart attack shortly after composing his opera Parsifal. Beyond the casino on the right, a baroque rusticated facade bore an even larger banner, this one deep blue, announcing the Capesaro, Galleria Internazionale d'Arte Moderna. Years ago, Langdon had been inside and seen Gustav Klimt's masterpiece, The Kiss, while it was on loan from Vienna. Klimt's dazzling gold-leaf rendering of intertwined lovers had sparked in him a passion for the artist's work, and to this day, Langdon credited Venice's Capesaro with arousing his lifelong gusto for modern art. Maurizio drove on, powering faster now in the wide canal. Ahead, the famous Rialto Bridge loomed, the halfway point to St. Mark's Square. As they neared the bridge, preparing to pass beneath it, Langdon looked up and saw a lone figure standing motionless at the railing, peering down at them with a somber visage. The face was both familiar and terrifying. Langdon recoiled on instinct. Grayish and elongated, the face had cold, dead eyes and a long, beaked nose. The boat slipped beneath the ominous figure just as Langdon realized it was nothing more than a tourist showing off a recent purchase, one of the hundreds of plague masks sold every day in the nearby Rialto Market. Today, however, the costume seemed anything but charming.